The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We're coming up on the 70th anniversary of Rosa Parks riding a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, the first week of December, 1955, and an incident in which there was some racial segregation going on, and they told her to get to the back of the bus. We're going to be talking to John K. Ballard about his book, Protesting with Rosa Parks, From Stagecoaches to Driving While Black. That's coming up in the Book Nook right after NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today John K. Ballard. He's the author of a new book. It's called Protesting with Rosa Parks, From Stagecoaches to Driving While Black. He joins us on the telephone in Massachusetts. Welcome to the program, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
John, before we dive into this subject, give us your bio. Who are you? You've done some very interesting things in your life.
Who am I? I'd like to know. Well, I'm essentially, I guess you might say, in one sense, I'm an academic. I spent many years working as a lexicographer, writing dictionaries, and teaching history of the English language, teaching medieval Welsh literature, and eventually, in the early 21st century, I became the managing editor of the African American National Biography Project at Harvard. And through that, as the editor of this project, I learned an awful lot of black history, because we put together about 4,000 short biographies of African Americans of note for one reason or another. And that provided the seed, at least, for this book. Got me interested in the whole matter of Jim Crow transportation.
When I saw your name, I thought it looked familiar. Have you had a chance yet to read the new book by Stefan Fatsis?
I haven't yet, no.
I'm just about positive he mentions you in that book, unabridged.
I do. I worked at Merriam-Webster as a pronunciation editor for about 10 years. Earlier today, I was listening to the radio, and they announced that they're just today publishing the new edition of their collegiate dictionary, which they haven't done for 22 years.
And it's probably the last print dictionary ever.
It may be. Who knows? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's quite a deal. Well, let's talk about this book.
I first got interested in this particular topic as editor of biographies just spanning black history from the earliest times until today. And After I left that position, I did some other things for a few years, but I kept thinking about people that I had learned about who had, let's say, suffered the same indignities as Rosa Parks did when she was told to move to the back of the bus. And in the process of my editing work, I had come across 10 or 12 other people throughout history, and began to realize that, well, people aren't aware of that. Most people aren't aware of that. Everyone knows the name Rosa Parks. And over the 14 years I've been working on this particular book, as I traveled, I would get in conversation with people and ask them, have you ever heard of Rosa Parks? And 100% of the people I asked said yes. And then I would ask them, can you name anyone else who did what she's most famous for? And 100% of the people said no. Well, not quite 100. I gave a talk once in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and afterwards a 10-year-old girl came running up to me, and she said, is Claudette Colvin in your book? I said, yes, she is. And she was the only person who had ever came up with another name. And as the more research I did, I began to find dozens and started writing about them. And finally, when I had written about 100 people, I stopped. The publisher said, okay, this book is fat enough.
So. Okay, let's move through the various conveyances and modes of transportation here. And the one thing that seemed to be a constant in these modes of transportation, and that was racism. Let's start off with stagecoaches.
One of the most important people in this topic, but I would also argue one of the most important civil rights activists ever that most people don't know about, was a man named David Ruggles, who, born in 1810, in the early 1830s, late 1820s, he moved to New York City. Absolutely fascinating man, but he began working for an abolitionist newspaper after trying some other businesses. He became very important in the business of protecting black people on the streets of New York from being kidnapped and either returned to the South as fugitive slaves or simply being kidnapped and sold to the South. He was very important that way. And in 1834, he got on a stagecoach from New York City to go to Newark, New Jersey. And he bought a first-class ticket. He got into the coach, and the driver said, no, you have to ride out here on top with me. And Ruggles said, no, I prefer to stay in my seat here. He did stay in his seat for a while. They crossed the river on the ferry, and the driver eventually insisted that he had to get out. And the driver and some other white passengers helped and violently threw Ruggles off of the stagecoach, injuring him somewhat. Not knowing, of course, they were not aware that he was an agent for the most widespread abolitionist newspaper of the time. And he is also a very good writer. So what he did was he wrote the story of what had happened to him, and he published it. And he took to doing that everywhere he traveled. He would always buy a first-class ticket. So he would get on the stagecoach, perhaps get thrown off. He would write about it. And trains were just starting to be built at the time. And very early in the process of establishing railroad lines, the practice of consigning black people to a separate car was instituted. This car that became known as the Jim Crow car. David Ruggles is actually the first person that we know of to use the terminology Jim Crow car in print. And he, I think by road of example, he taught other people, other black people traveling, to do the same thing. And in the early 1840s, there was a considerable amount of travel around the Northeast, in New England and New York in particular, some in Pennsylvania, of people traveling from one town to another to anti-slavery meetings, abolitionists traveling. And they would make a practice of buying a first-class ticket to get into the first-class white people's car, and as often as not, get thrown out or get forced to go ride in the Jim Crow car. The Jim Crow car was usually just the baggage car, which might have had a wooden bench in it. It might not have, or it might have just been a dirty old empty car. Something like we would think of a boxcar these days, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So we owe a lot of that to David Ruggles.
We need to pause for just a moment to take a break, but before we do, I just want to mention how wonderful our supporting libraries are that bring you the Book Nook every week on Saturday at 7 and on Sunday at 10:30. Those are mornings filled with books on public radio, and we bring you books throughout the year on public radio because our libraries bring you books every single day. And your library card is your ticket to travel anywhere in the universe and never even leave the comfort of your chair. We'll continue with the Book Nook. I hope you're reading something good today or tonight or whenever you're listening, because the Book Nook comes to you as a podcast as well. You can listen anytime you want by going to wyso.org. We have almost 1,200 podcasts archived there. You can listen to them when you have insomnia at 3 o'clock in the morning. I guarantee they'll put you right back to sleep. Now this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I've been joined by John Ballard on the phone in Massachusetts. And we were talking about David Ruggles.
One of the people, a fugitive slave, one of the people who appeared at his door was a young black man who had just made his own way away from slavery in Maryland, came to David Ruggles' door, and Ruggles took him in, kept him there for a couple of weeks, taught him how to behave, you know, how to not be too conspicuous, and then sent him on to New Bedford, Massachusetts, where he had experience, or this young man had experience in boat shipbuilding. And while he was there, then that former slave changed his name to Frederick Douglass and became the most famous and most powerful writer among African Americans in the 19th century.
You have an account in the book of Frederick Douglass riding in the Jim Crow car on a wintry day, and it's just horrifying to read the conditions that he had to endure and all these other people had to endure.
Yeah, that passage just sort of describes the car that they're in, with only one little 7x9 pane of glass for a window, I guess, and had to keep the doors open because people were smoking in there, so you could hardly breathe. Plus, the car was equipped with shovels in order to shovel the snow off of the seats. During that trip, Frederick Douglass became quite ill and fortunately recovered.
The book is Protesting with Rosa Parks, From Stagecoaches to Driving While Black. I've been joined by John K. Ballard. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, Fact-Based Journalism in Service of Democracy. And on these trains, when someone would object to being removed from their first-class compartment that they had paid for, frequently a group of thugs would come in and encounter them. Railroad thugs.
Yeah, the conductor would call some of the baggage handlers or other employees of the railroad to come and force people to go back into the Jim Crow car, or simply beat them up and throw them off the train altogether.
Mm.
Both men and women. It was absolutely horrifying. There was considerable objection to it. Such cases were regularly covered in the abolitionist newspapers of the day. It was all seen as part of the sort of process of objecting to slavery and of trying to get states to abolish slavery, but also just to establish equal rights for everyone, equal rights in traveling.
Mm. And as we move through developments in transportation, the one constant was this racist situation with public transportation, and a lot of these people went to court over this.
Exactly, yeah. The very first person in the book that I was able to discover who protested in court was actually an immigrant from Brazil. A man named Emiliano Mandruco in 1832 was he and his wife were denied cabin passage on a steamboat that went from New Bedford to Nantucket Island. They were denied cabin passage, which just meant that they had to stay out on the open deck. And his wife was ill, and he refused that. So he went to court and sued, and he lost his case in court. A couple of years later, David Ruggles did the same thing when he was thrown off a train. And he went to court. He made a very forceful suit against the train line and against the conductor. The judge, a well-known judge, as it turned out, a Boston judge, finally decided that, well, it was just in the natural course of things that black people should not travel together with white people. That's just the way God made things, he decided. And Ruggles lost that case. That happened over and over again as people objected to their mistreatment and sued the railroads and sued the conductors. One of my favorite cases to mention anyway is in the story of Ida B. Wells, mm-hmm. Ida B. Wells Barnett, whose name is still well recognized. Later in the 19th century, in 1883, she was 21. She was a school teacher. She taught young children. She was her parents had died, and she was trying to support her five younger siblings. And she had to take a train to where she taught. She was thrown off the train, and she sued in Memphis. This was in Memphis, Tennessee. And she sued, and she won the suit, which was very exciting to her, of course. But then the railroad appealed. And eventually the appeal went to the Tennessee Supreme Court, and the Tennessee Supreme Court reversed the decision. And if I might, I'd like to just sort of read a little passage of what Ida Wells then put in her personal diary that she was just keeping for herself when she got that news. This is what she wrote, which I find very moving and very telling. She wrote, "The Supreme Court reversed the decision of the lower court in my behalf last week. Went to see Judge G this afternoon, and he tells me four of them cast their personal prejudice in the scale of justice and decided in the face of all the evidence to the contrary that the smoking car was a first-class coach for colored people, as provided for by that statute that calls for separate coaches, but first class for the races. I felt so disappointed because I had hoped such great things from my suit for my people generally. I have firmly believed all along that the law was on our side and would, when we appealed to it, give us justice. I feel shorn of that belief and utterly discouraged, and just now, if it were possible, would gather my race in my arms and fly far away with them. O God, is there no rest, no peace, no justice in this land for us? Thou hast always fought the battles of the weak and oppressed. Come to my aid at this moment and teach me what to do, for I am sorely disappointed. Show us the way, even as thou led the children of Israel out of bondage into the promised land. Incredibly moving little statement that she wrote just for herself. What happened? She lost her job as a school teacher when she published an account of what had happened to her. But the people who published it liked what she wrote and asked her to write something else, and she became a journalist. And eventually, she became quite famous throughout the country in her research into the history and practice of lynching in this country. And her work on lynching is still an important work. It's still cited today. And she became essentially our first investigative journalist, teaching us how to do true investigative journalism.
They called them muckrakers, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, muckrakers. Yeah. If you're just tuning in, my guest is John K. Ballard. His book is Protesting with Rosa Parks, From Stagecoaches to Driving While Black. And we actually get some pretty shocking information in this book. At least it was shocking to me that some of the worst racism, at least in the early part of your book, is happening up in these areas in the Northeast that you mentioned that you would think would be a little more tolerant, but they're not.
You would think that. I guess there's a couple ways to think about it. Before the abolition of slavery, in any case, black people weren't traveling.
Mm.
But free black people, even in the South, they had to travel some, but there was no question that they would be able to ride on the trains with white people. That wouldn't have happened. But it was quite frequent in the North and throughout the country. The practice spread not only to trains and steamboats, as we had mentioned earlier, but also to streetcars in cities that were large enough to have streetcar lines, mm-hmm. Certainly like New York City. There were constant protests against that. Either protests that were intentional, that were planned, but most often protests that were mounted because someone who perhaps was even in the habit of riding the streetcar normally, came up against a streetcar conductor who decided to kick him off.
Hmm.
And then that case might go to court. A number of people just made a practice of doing that. Some very fascinating, interesting people.
Some very brave people, and
extraordinarily brave,
and some very articulate people, because they wrote about it, and it's very impressive. The book is Protesting with Rosa Parks. There's some very important Supreme Court decisions that I think we need to cover here briefly. Dred Scott and Plessy versus Ferguson. Explain to us the importance of these.
The Dred Scott decision in, was it 1854, if I remember right, or 1857, somewhere in the 1850s there. That was the decision often considered to be the worst decision the Supreme Court has ever made, that decided that black people were not citizens of the United States, and that they did not have the right to vote, and that they were not even counted in the censuses as a full person, but as only three-fifths of a person. There was a case, a Jim Crow case, in which someone was thrown off a train, took them to court, and then was going to appeal the case when he lost it, but the Dred Scott decision ruled that he was not a citizen, ruled that no blacks were a citizen. Therefore, he could not appear in court anymore. And that the Dred Scott decision just affected race relations everywhere. It was a terrible, terrible moment in American history. And if we go through to the end of the 19th century, we come against the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, in which a test case was actually intentionally tried in New Orleans, where a man, Homer Plessy, got on a train in Louisiana, announced beforehand that he was going to, and sat in the white car, and was arrested in order to take that case into court in Louisiana to test the whole principle. And that was the case in which it got decided that the doctrine of separate but equal was decided.
Mm-hmm.
And that pertained all the way up through the first half of the 20th century, through the arrest of Rosa Parks, and the practice, of course, continued later, but it was no longer legal after that.
As you mentioned earlier, most people know who Rosa Parks was. I was somewhat familiar with the situation when she was arrested and prosecuted for that bus ride in Montgomery, Alabama. But I was not aware, number one, that this was kind of a setup, and number two, that the driver of that bus was someone that she'd had troubles with in the past.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. And it had been about 12 years earlier, he had kicked her off his bus, and she vowed to never ride a bus that he was driving again. And it may just sort of have been that in 1955, she didn't notice when she got on the bus. Or she probably wouldn't have ridden with him. But it did happen that way. I wouldn't go so far as to call it a setup.
Okay.
It was not a planned protest. She was working as a seamstress for a department store, doing alterations on things. And was on her way home when she was told to vacate her seat so that a white passenger could sit down. Actually, all the passengers in that whole row had to vacate their seats because a white passenger could never be expected to sit next to a black person.
Mm.
But she refused to. She refused to get up. Now she hadn't planned that. But who was she? She was had been for some time the secretary of the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP, and that chapter had been looking for a test case to take to the courts to try, and there had been four other women arrested in Montgomery that very year. Mrs. Parks was arrested in December, and from the earlier part of that year, from March on, there were four other women who had been arrested. But they did not end up being sort of suitable cases for various personal and legalistic reasons. But when it happened to Rosa Parks, she was very well informed as to, you know, what the situation was and what to do. And obviously, as secretary of the NAACP, she had a connection right off the bat with the president of that chapter and with with lawyers, a very young lawyer named Fred Gray who took on her case. And so it immediately, once the word went out that evening that she had been arrested, some other people in Montgomery organized the bus boycott. They printed up thousands and thousands of notices of circulars that were distributed all over town over the weekend, saying, "Don't ride the bus on Monday." And then when Ms. Parks was found guilty, that bus boycott continued, and it continued for a whole year, until eventually the case got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that segregation on the buses was illegal.
And we're coming up on the 70th anniversary of that occurring, and we need to take a break here in the Book Nook, and it's hard to believe it was 70 years ago, the first week of December 1955, that Rosa Parks got on that bus in Montgomery, Alabama. The book will continue, the Book Nook, that is, right here on your public radio station, right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. When I came to the station in 1993, I can remember there was a closet right across from our offices, and I got to look inside that closet, and it was filled with reel-to-reel tapes. And those tapes were treasures, and fortunately, they were preserved. One of them contained a tape of a commencement speech that was made during the 1960s on the campus of Antioch College in Yellow Springs. A fellow named Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave that speech, and we were able to digitize that and preserve it from that old reel-to-reel tape. And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is a part of this story because the situation in Montgomery, Alabama caused him to become involved, and Rosa Parks was a big part of that, of course. And then he took off doing what he did so well. And he's a big part of the story. We were talking about the Montgomery bus boycott with my guest, John Bollard. Let's continue with that. There was a young minister there in Montgomery who got involved.
He did. He did. He might have been surprised to be involved in something so important so quickly and so early in his career. That was the young Martin Luther King Jr., who had just become a minister in Montgomery. As it happens, his was the right voice to take up to take the case to the public in particular, and to serve as the most visible of some of the very important ministers and activists who managed the Montgomery bus boycott, and that, of course, set him on his career as you know, one of the greatest thinkers and black activists of the 20th century. But he was surrounded with many others, one of whom, which I can't refrain from mentioning, was Bayard Rustin,
mm-hmm.
who is starting to be known these days. A quite interesting film about him, just titled Rustin, was made recently, which I recommend. Bayard Rustin kind of grew up protesting throughout his life in Pennsylvania. And he grew up, his grandmother was Quaker, and so he grew up under a lot of Quaker thinking and became a pacifist. And he is the one who taught nonviolent theory to Dr. King, which makes him very, very important. But he had also, before that, managed several very, very important protests, shall we say, against traveling Jim Crow, including in the 1940s, in 1947. The Supreme Court had ruled in 1946 that segregation on buses traveling interstate from one state to another, that was unconstitutional. And so in 1947, Bayard Rustin and some colleagues with the Congress of Racial Equality decided to test whether that Supreme Court decision changed the way people were behaving. And so a group of, let's say, half a dozen white men and a half a dozen black men would get on the bus with a ticket to the next state. And then the black men would sit in the front, some of them, and the white men would sit in the back, and a couple of them would sit where they were supposed to sit just to be witnesses and also to provide bail if anybody got arrested. And they traveled from state to state testing and discovering that that the law was not being followed. They were just behaving the way they had been for the past 80 or 90 years by that point.
Mm-hmm. This was the Journey of Reconciliation.
The Journey of Reconciliation, it was called, yes. Mm-hmm. And that provided the model. Same thing happened after the Supreme Court ruled against segregation in the Montgomery bus boycott case. Things didn't change a lot. And so after that, in the 1960s, 1961, just a few years afterwards, we get the Freedom Rides, led by John Lewis and many other really significant young people in particular. And those Freedom Rides were modeled on the Journey of Reconciliation that Bayard Rustin had established back in the 40s.
Mm.
So the history carries through. I see all of this, right from David Ruggles all the way on through to John Lewis and beyond. This is an unbroken stream of protest against the racism in this country. And that unbroken stream of protest keeps the issue in the public eye in a positive way. And by positive, I mean in a way that people are protesting against it. They're not acquiescing to Jim Crow.
My guest is John K. Ballard. His book is Protesting with Rosa Parks, From Stagecoaches to Driving While Black. Last year, I had a guest on the show who'd written a memoir about being in the Peace Corps back in the 1960s in Africa, and he was at the embassy, the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi in the late 1960s, and he saw a guy sitting there in the embassy, kind of sitting off by himself, and he went over to talk to him. And it was Bayard Rustin, and he met Bayard Rustin. And it's my understanding that later in life, like in the late 60s when the Black Power movement came into force, that Rustin kind of went away from the pacifist approach.
He had to lay low for quite a while because the FBI was always after him, partly because he was gay.
Right.
maybe to a great extent because he was gay.
Sure.
But also because they just saw him as a troublemaker. He was a primary organizer of the March on Washington in 1963,
okay.
During which Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech.
Were you there?
I was not there.
Okay.
No. I wish I was.
All right.
I was there 2 years later, though, to hear Dr. King give his famous "How Long" speech.
Mm.
How long, not long. You know,
mm-hmm.
this speech that references the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. That was in 1965, at the end of the march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. I was fortunate enough to be there for that occasion.
Well, speaking of a non-pacifist approach, you have a person in here named Mary Church Terrell, and on June 26, 1908, she had an incident where she did not take a pacifist approach, and she caught my eye because she had some connections to our local area here. She had attended an integrated school affiliated with Antioch College in Yellow Springs, and she also taught at Wilberforce, and we're right here in Yellow Springs. And isn't she the one who punched a guy or slapped him?
Yeah, I think she did, on a train, or threatened to.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if she actually did, but she certainly threatened to.
I liked her.
She was quite forceful, and she was very, very important, especially in the Black women's movement, and kept these issues alive well into her 80s. She never stopped her activism. There are photos of her in her 80s out on the streets carrying a sign. And she was also a proponent of respectability. That people should be, respectable in their behavior and in their appearance and in their lives. And was very influential in that sense. But she was also adamant. She would not give away. She integrated not only trains and buses, but also movie theaters and restaurants.
You have one person in here who's actually fictional, and that's Bigger Number Five.
Bigger Number Five. I love Bigger Number Five. He is one of the models for the character of Bigger Thomas in Richard Wright's Native Son. Richard Wright wrote an article about who was Bigger Thomas. Bigger Thomas is a very tough character. It's a difficult novel to read. It's very, very hard, and it's hard to like Bigger Thomas, but it's hard not to understand where he's coming from and how racism has created a person such as him. So Richard Wright wrote an article on where did Bigger Thomas come from? Where do you get the idea for Bigger Thomas? And he names four or five different, not specific people, but at least types of people who became troublemakers of some sort, we might say.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those, he said, was a man who was on the bus, black man who sat down towards the front of the bus, and the bus driver told him to move to the back, and this man reached into his pocket and pulled out his jackknife and just sat there with it and said to the bus driver, "Make me."
Uh-huh.
And the bus driver went back and sat down and drove the bus.
Uh-huh.
And Wright sort of points out how the other black riders back in the back of the bus, in the back seat of the bus, how they were all really thrilled that, you know, someone like them had stood up and won the case like that. And it reads very much, Wright doesn't say so explicitly, but it reads very much like a scene that he must have seen himself back in the 1920s.
John, near the end of the book, you talk about racial profiling. We certainly have a lot of that going on in our country right now, don't we?
We do. We do. And it's I don't know, it's spread much more widely and much more rapidly than I ever would have expected it to in our present situation. Just to sort of make a link, after the Freedom Rides, after segregation was made illegal on buses and all other forms of transportation, a number of things happened, but one of them was that buses became less important and the private car became more important. And so rather than having people getting, you know, required to sit in the back of the bus or something like that, we started getting more racial profiling, which was harassing people in their private cars. So police, for instance, stopping a car for some minor infraction, changing the lane or not signaling or something, and then that situation builds up until it becomes, in numerous cases, quite tragic, and somebody dies, a driver ends up being killed. The cases that I cite in my book are the cases of Sandra Bland and Philando Castile and finally Tyree Nichols, all in recent times, which this behavior is all just sort of part of, conditioned by and part of the racism that has persisted.
Mm-hmm.
From the very earliest times. So, you know, we started back here in 1832, and that brings us up to, 2023 now.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are today. I think one of the positive things I hope that this book can demonstrate is that to protest personally like that, and like many people are doing, and millions of people are doing these days, is a very important thing to do. That is how change is often brought about, is instituted. That people have to make their own beliefs strongly felt.
Mm. Well, this is quite a book, and we're coming up on the 70th anniversary of Rosa Parks on that bus in Montgomery, Alabama, at the first week of December. And the book is Protesting with Rosa Parks, From Stagecoaches to Driving While Black. John K. Ballard has been my guest. And before I let you go, John, I am intrigued by the part of your career where you are an expert on medieval Welsh poetry. I want to know how this happened and how you got so immersed in this.
Well, I've been immersed in that much longer than I have in black history, so to speak. As a college student at the University of Rochester in the 60s, I became increasingly interested in medieval literature, and particularly Arthurian legends of King Arthur. Decided to pursue that in graduate school to study the origins of Arthurian literature, which grew out of Wales and out of Welsh literature. And Welsh poetry is the oldest surviving vernacular poetry in Europe, going back to the 6th century. And I just got interested in it, and some of the tales are just so fascinating that I just kept working in that field for many years.
What are your hopes for this book? What are your aspirations for it?
My aspirations are to help people to find out about this history that we don't know about. We have not been taught about this very much in schools. That there is this long history, that Rosa Parks, as she herself said in 1988, I was not the only one. She says many people don't know, I was not the only one. Well, by far she wasn't. My hope for this book is that people of all sorts will find out through it something more about their history, about our history. This is all our history because we're all in this together.
Thank you for your time today, John.
Well, thank you for yours, and thanks for doing this. I've enjoyed it very much.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. My guest has been John K. Ballard. His book is Protesting with Rosa Parks, From Stagecoaches to Driving While Black. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned to your public radio station, WYSO.